Dark Phoenix, Days of Future Past, Wolverine, and pretty much everything that goes along with the X-Men on movies, TV, and in the comics all can be traced back to Chris Claremont. And tonight, we're going to be speaking with Patrick Meany, who has made a film called Chris Claremont's X-Men. Marvel TV Weekly starts now!
You're tuning into the destination for TV superfan discussion, AfterBuzz TV. And now, let the buzz begin!
That's right, it's our default national anthem here on Marvel TV Weekly. It is indeed the 90s X-Men theme, which as it was ramping up, Amy's like, oh wait, that does sound kind of familiar, because we were talking. Amy didn't think that she watched the X-Men animated series, but
how do I know? This is crazy.
Because it was probably. Do you have siblings?
No.
Oh, all right. Well, then you must have watched it at some point. Anyway, I'm Christian Blatt. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at ChristianDMZ. And as I was saying, next to me, for those watching on YouTube, Amy.
Hi everyone. I missed you guys last week. I'm so excited to be back. I am Amy Cassandra Martinez, and you can find me on all social media at Amy Cassandra MTZ.
And on the other side of the desk, the only one of us who has an X in their Twitter handle, Michael X Shirley.
Yes.
Welcome. Again, this is an amazing shirt that I think is actually from the 90s.
1993.
I have the cover to Giant Size X-Men, but this shirt is not from 1975. It's from like 3 years ago.
Yeah,
so,
but that shirt nice
is legit. And, you know, it's got a lot of things on there.
Nice.
Well, you know, we can have a meet and greet afterwards. People can just touch the shoulders. And again, our special guest, Patrick Meany. First of all, thank you for coming out to the studio tonight to talk about X-Men and more with us.
No, thanks for having me.
And people can find you at Patrick Meany, and I should spell that it's M-E-A-N-E-Y.
Yep.
And PatrickMeany.com. And the documentary in question, Chris Claremont's X-Men, video on demand, Amazon, iTunes, all those good places.
Yep.
And we'll also, a little later in the show, talk about the horror movie that you directed, House of Demons, also available on demand, Amazon, iTunes, all that good stuff, right?
Yep, all right, transactionals.
Good. I'm glad that everything can be found so easily, you know? And, you know, just like comic books can be found so easily now.
Nice.
You know, a lot of the stories, a lot of these great stories that Chris Claremont told, I didn't read them for a long time because they were really expensive. But now, I could read them all on my phone if I wanted to. You know, I could sign up for Marvel Unlimited or some other service. But I kind of wonder, let's trace it back to sort of the beginning for you. When did you first find the X-Men? What's your first memory of those characters?
It was the cartoon show.
Okay.
I think, like, a lot of people who are, you know, roughly my age, like, that was... it was a little more sophisticated than other cartoons, if not as, you know... super sophisticated.
Yeah.
I think it's a pretty strong like adaptation of what Chris was doing on the series.
Yeah, and as of now, that adaptation of the Dark Phoenix saga is the only good one we've ever seen.
Yes.
Because X-Men 3 The Last Stand, even though it has a great cameo by Chris Claremont in the movie, it is an awful film, and I'm not putting words in your mouth. I'm saying that. I found it to be... wanting, let's just say. And I think that a lot of the story, you know, they did Days of Future Past. They did a lot of the great stories from, you know, Chris's run on the Uncanny X-Men, and X-Men in general, on that show. And they did them so closely that, unless I'm mistaken, Chris actually gets a story by credit in the Dark Phoenix saga on the, you know, which is kind of unheard of because it's usually like, oh, we're just going to steal a, you know, I'm pretty sure that. You know, none of the Batman animated series is, you know, to Bill Finger or Bob Kane. You know, they don't get any story by credits or created by or anything. So it's a testament, really, to just sort of how great those stories are. So were you at all familiar with them, or just that was a show? You're like, oh, I like this show just like I like other shows, the X-Men animated series?
Yeah, it was, you know, I just watched the show, and I didn't read a lot of comics at the time.
Sure.
I had read, like, a couple of comics of, like, even X-Men stuff, and it was very, like, I had no idea what was going on, because it was, you know, in the middle of the 90s, and it was very convoluted and sort of...
So by the time that you even looked at it, Chris Claremont had moved on.
Chris was already gone.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I, like everyone else, had, like, a copy of X-Men #1, but at the time, it was, you know, it's a little hard to... It's not a great number one from the perspective of a new reader.
Yeah, it's not very accessible. And I mean, it's a number one, but there were like 278 issues of Uncanny at that point, not to mention various, you know, miniseries and spinoffs and things. I was lucky enough to interview Chris Claremont for my personal podcast a few years ago, and I told him that the first issue that I read was Uncanny X-Men number 176, and basically in that episode, in that issue, Cyclops and Madeline Pryor, who we find out, a lot of you're laughing, a clone of Jean Grey is something that's eventually decided, and they fight a squid, and that's the whole issue. Mm-hmm. But I was like, wow, that... I really don't know what's going on, but I want to know more. I want to be like, let me into the club. Like, yeah. I want to know why I don't know what's going on. And he thought it was kind of a, you know, he actually kind of laughed that was the, you know, that was just the one that I chose. Mm-hmm. But you start to hear about all these things. You hear about Dark Phoenix. You hear about Days of Future Past. And as I alluded to a few minutes ago, and we were talking before the show, those, you just couldn't get them until they put out trade paperbacks, because it's like everything, you know, had, you know, just a huge, tremendously inflated value, all those stories. And also, I mean, if you lived in a small town like I did, you had the issues that were on the newsstand, and, you know, if you missed it, that was it. Mm. So, you weren't getting to go back and find them. So at what point did you realize then that Chris Claremont was actually the pretty much the single person responsible for so much of the great stories that were told for the X-Men from 1975 through 1991.
Well, I think it's probably unusual, because I started with, at the time they were putting out these essential X-Men books, sure, which were very cheap, like kind of phone book style collections.
Were they black and white on
they
the
inside? They were
black
and white,
yeah. Those, yeah.
So they were like 25 issues for like $15. And I had looked up online. I was like, where's the best place to start with the X-Men? Because I liked all the characters. I liked the concept. I thought it was really cool. I was intrigued by all the stuff. And I started at the beginning and then read all the essentials that were in print, and then kind of hunted down the issues or, you know, trades or whatever that were available. And I made my way through the whole Claremont run and read it as sort of one unit.
Sure.
Which I think is unusual, because I think most people either were reading it at the time or kind of cherry pick like pieces. So I think that really gave me an appreciation of like, wow, like this guy created all this, like everything X-Men. It's hard because you can't really say he created X-Men, but he created X-Men for all like what X-Men is.
Yeah, and I mean, the interesting thing is the T-shirt that I'm wearing is for Giant Size X-Men number one, which introduced the new team. He actually didn't write that. Mm. But you talked to, is it Len Wein?
Len Wein, I think.
Yeah, Len Wein is the one who wrote it, but he was actually too busy to write the monthly book. So Chris starts writing with Uncanny. It wasn't actually called Uncanny X-Men at that point. X-Men number 94, he starts writing it. So he's basically from that point onward, and so he develops these characters into who we know. But yeah, he didn't create any of like these main characters, but he's so responsible for who they are, because as he talks about in your film, that, you know, they could do whatever they wanted, because X-Men came out every other month, and prior to the new team, it was just reprints of old issues, you know. I mean, it was definitely sort of a forgotten book. Which is crazy to think about when you think of the people that worked on, you know, even after Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, just all these great characters and all that. It's just, but it just, I don't know, it just didn't capture people's attention.
Yeah.
There are, of course, other people responsible, which would be the artists involved. Initially, you have Dave Cockrum, who has what I think is like a great comic book style. You know, it's like it's Kirby-esque, more, you know, sort of like Jack Kirby or even John Romita Sr. from Spider-Man. And it's, you know, really the design and the look and the feel for, you know, right up through Phoenix, really.
Yep.
And then John Byrne, I think, is that sort of when everything was firing on all cylinders. It was Chris Claremont, John Byrne, you know, and he would get some writing credit as well. And that's probably the sweet spot, I would say, you know, right? That run basically from Uncanny X-Men 100 through like 150. There's plenty of great stories that come after that, but so many, there's just so much in there. And it's like, do you have time to read 50 comics? Read those, you know, but you might not. So that's why I tell people, it's like, well, you should read the Dark Phoenix saga, because to me, that, if you look at it in the context of 1979, 1980, when it came out, that to me is just the greatest story that was ever told in comic books, not the Bible. That's a different, it's a different story, Michael. So in any case, that's just sort of some of my thoughts on that. But I wanted to kind of talk first to Michael and then to Amy, just sort of your own association with the X-Men when you first found them, and some of who your favorite characters were on the show and in the comics. Michael, you first.
Oh, you know, I kind of got I got started with comic books through collecting comic book cards. My dad was a big my dad was a big baseball card collector, so when he would go and get a box comic or baseball cards, he would get me a box of comic book cards, and then I would like complete them, and then go to the comic book shop and try to trade for the ones I didn't have, you know, and do stuff like that. And I just got really into the mythology of the characters, and then came the action figures, and then came the comic books.
Yeah, so who were your favorites from the different stages? So, like, who looked cool on a card and who was great as an action figure?
Quicksilver's, like, one of my favorites, for sure.
And I think they've done a great job with him in the X-Men movies. Not as great a job in,
I would
in
not agree
Age of Ultron,
with you,
but you you don't like Quicksilver?
No.
Those scenes, the scenes with Quicksilver stand out in Days of Future Past, which is my favorite X-Men movie, and I would say Apocalypse, not my favorite X-Men movie, but that scene really stands out. So you don't like the way he's been done there?
No. Okay. No. Fair enough. I don't like the Elizabeth Olsen thing either.
I don't know if anyone does.
Because I like Scarlet Witch a lot, too. But Dazzler, Jean, like Rachel Gray. I love that whole family. Yeah. Like, just that whole, like, Summers family, the whole Maximoff family, which trickles, you know, down to Emma and then her... 1001.
Yeah.
Daughters. Esme.
Right, which we talked about.
The Gifted.
Yeah, which we talked about. And yeah, that's another way where a lot of these storylines and characters that Chris Claremont created. I mean, we didn't even really touch on New Mutants, which we will, and you did in the film, Patrick. That's where Legion came from. And the concept for Legion is from a sort of a groundbreaking run of New Mutants that was completely lost on me as a 10-year-old. I was like, this doesn't look like anything. These aren't comic books. What is this crazy art style? But so those I'd say Gifted and Legion are not the stories that they would not be able to be the stories they are if not for Chris Claremont.
One of my you were asking about action figures. I don't know if did you ever have any action
figures?
I
had a few.
One of my favorites was the Corsair action figure.
I love Corsair.
It is a really good action figure. It looks just like him, and it's not like a repainted version of like another figure. It's a really good one.
Yeah, I know. I had a lot of Marvel Superhero Secret Wars action figures, and they were usually the same body with just a different head. Almost all of them were the same body. So Amy, but back to you. So who are some of you found the X-Men. You don't remember watching the animated series, but that song sounded familiar to you.
Yeah, that's cool.
But you remember them from the movie. So who are some of your favorite characters there?
I liked Jean Grey. I liked
from the movie. You liked her in the movie.
I mean, here's the thing.
sorry. I like Famke Janssen, but oh no.
Yeah. Okay. So I didn't really get involved in Marvel until like Iron Man. So all of this before, I was like, oh, this is cool. I hadn't really known anything about them. And so it was all new, so it was all pretty cool to me. Rogue was pretty fun as well.
Yeah.
And then, of course, like Magneto. Mm. I think he's really cool.
He's
like,
a good Magneto.
The idea behind Magneto is so cool, which is why I really love the documentary, because I really got to learn a lot, way more than I did watching X-Men.
Right, and just see like all of these things like, hey, that's a title of a movie.
Yeah.
That's a title of a movie.
I know that person.
Oh, Legion, that's a TV show. Yeah, so you see all these things.
It's connecting everything. So, I did not see X-Men, Days of Future Past, Apocalypse, Dark Phoenix, because After The Last Stand, I was like,
ah. Look, After The Last Stand, see, and then you have to keep in mind, too, that The Last Stand was followed by X-Men Origins Wolverine. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, I don't know if I ever want to see an X-Men movie again. And I, of course I did. But I thought for a minute, I was just like, what are they doing? You know, it's like, they have these great characters. And especially in the shape of Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. They had perfect cast. Mm. And then they went and made garbage movies. And that was infuriating.
Perfect cast.
Well, and I mean
so, I'm saying Hugh Jackman is perfect. You try to say that he's not?
Oh, he's great.
You're like, oh, it should have been. No, it would have been better if Doug Ray Scott had been available to be him as he was supposed to.
I wasn't a fan of Halle Berry as Storm.
Really?
I mean, Halle Berry's terrible as Storm.
Did you notice that, like, her accent, like, just kind of, like, oh, she doesn't have one anymore.
Did you like Storm in Apocalypse?
All right.
Because that's Mohawk Storm.
Like, I didn't like want the viewers to know. Like literally, wait, I haven't.
We had this conversation like 2 weeks ago. You've had so much time to watch it.
I didn't have, think I was out. I have Apocalypse like on DVD, and I've just been too scared to watch it because I don't want to hate it. And
you'll hate things.
I was
about
told
it.
That I you'll would. I would not it. Like yeah. it. And Tony told me that it wasn't so bad that
no,
I should
it's
be
not
scared.
The worst one.
But I
no,
still I just haven't.
You should still definitely watch it.
I mean, it is literally brand new. Haven't seen it.
I mean, it has like arguably, I feel like the best cast of any movie of all time. It's like insanely stacked cast, and it's such a great film. So
you're talking about
Apocalypse? I mean, it has Fassbender, McAvoy, Jennifer Lawrence, Oscar Isaac, etc. Yeah. Like it's crazy.
You're right. It's probably the best cast superhero movie, and it's not great.
Is Ellen Page in it?
No, she's not. No, you don't like her.
Okay,
but I wish somebody played Kitty in that movie because
you can't have another one. Well, I guess they did have two of everyone now.
Yeah, well, there were three Kitties and three Jubilees, and so you know, in the course of the movies, they didn't really say anything. So
I know what you were saying though. I do like the look of her outfit. I've seen the trailer for Apocalypse, and I do like the look of her outfit. Storm's
outfit. That's actually the period that I was reading X-Men, when Storm had lost her powers. Punk rock Storm. And
that's cool.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's,
I think
it's
that's
a very bold
the
move.
Best era. I think Paul Smith era of Claremont, when Storm has the Mohawk, is very, like, character focused. That's my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, and they talk, and I think he talks about it in the movie that, you know, there's two issues, Life Death and Life Death 2, 186 and 198 of Uncanny, and they are not superhero stories at all. It's like, you know, and it's interesting because it's like, Life Death 1, it really is like, oh, I had a really nice dinner with Forge, and we're just talking. And that's sort of why I like the Chris Claremont X-Men so much. Is there were the great, you know, spacefaring, huge storylines, but I love the issues where they'd play baseball and or they'd go out into town and there'd be like a minor little fracas. But, you know, I just liked watching them interact together and just being friends, and it really humanized them.
Well, I think it's analogous to a lot of like the way people watch like Buffy or something on TV, where you love the cast, and like even a bad episode of Buffy is more enjoyable than a great episode of a lot of shows because you're like I love these characters. Yes. So I think that was his greatest strength, is that it was really, the characters were very grounded, they're very realistic, and they change a lot, which is very unusual in comics, because a lot of comics is almost like jazz. It's like you'll play whatever, like When the Saints Go Marching In 100 different ways, and it's about like how you interpret it. But with X-Men, it was an evolution, and Wolverine of 94 is not the same character as Wolverine of, you know, 200 or 250.
Yeah, no, I mean, especially, and he's really not the character of Wolverine as introduced in Incredible Hulk, I think 181, where they, and it's talked about in the film, they thought that the claws came out of his gloves, you know, and it was just sort of, Chris had this idea, well, what about it, you know, it literally cuts him every time that he has to
love
use
that.
And it's such a fascinating idea, and that's why these stories, I always say, it's so important to look at in the context of when they were written. As great as it can be to read the Dark Phoenix saga, just poke around and see what else was happening in comic books in 1979 and 1980, and be like, oh, there's nothing like this. You know, I mean, before too long, all of a sudden, things really started to, you know, be like, hey, let's try and do more stuff like that.
Well,
know?
I think even on TV, I mean, TV at the time was all standalone episodes. There was real no analogous to, like, a story that was so sustained. And I think it can be hard, because it is hard to read it as one chunk, to really appreciate that, how much it is kind of one story, which threads, like, it, you know, 1 through 3 of the Jim Lee X-Men. It is a, you know, it's not the perfect conclusion, but it is a conclusion to this, like, 180 long issue saga.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. And if you do get a chance to read it all in a go, you can see, like, these kind of rising and falling movements within the overall thing.
Yeah. When I was a kid reading comics, they introduced a series called Classic X-Men, which they eventually called X-Men Classic. And they, so I was able to go back and see all these comics that, because this is before, like, the giant collections.
They
hadn't quite caught on to that yet. So I would get to read all these stories that I'd heard so much about. So getting to kind of see them, but then also simultaneously reading stories from, like, 87, 88, you're like, oh, look at how this ties back. Yeah. And, you know, they were able to kind of stick in these backup stories that were, would actually tie some of those things a little bit more forward. But Claremont wrote all of them.
Yeah.
And as you talk about in the film, he wrote X-Men. He started writing Wolverine. He wrote New Mutants for a long time. He wrote Excalibur, a particular favorite of Michael and mine. And he just was writing.
Well, even the stuff he didn't write, like X-Factor and New Mutants later on, it was Louise Simonson who was very tight with him. And it was almost analogous to like a TV writer's room sort of thing, where they worked very closely together.
Yeah, which is actually the thing that I would say, the thing that I never really thought about until I watched the film, was the importance of the editors in helping shape that narrative. And, you know, Chris was writing these superhero comics that were very female-centric and female-driven. Didn't hurt that he had, you know, Louise Simonson, prior to that she was Louise Jones, and also Anne Nesenti. Just the fact that they were like this little team, I loved watching the three of them talk.
Yeah.
Was very recent, I assume, that you got the three of them together.
It wasn't that long ago, yeah. So, but it was interesting because I think Anne is very not a comics fan, and she's somebody who has a lot of interests. And if you read the issues that she edited, they are a lot more experimental, like the Sienkiewicz X-Men or New Mutants, the Life Death. It's sort of a very like experimental era when she was working with them. And then I think once she kind of went on to do like Daredevil and her other books that she was writing, you can see it sort of like pulling back towards the, you know, more conventional storytelling.
Yeah, I think when you're actually out in the forefront, you kind of need to tell those kind of stories. And, you know, Louise also ends up, you know, she writes the first appearance of Apocalypse in X-Factor. So, you know, she was also, you know, it was basically like it was the team that was putting these stories out. And you just really, you know, you really felt that from the film, which I thought was great. What did you think about that, Amy? Getting to see that, you know, this guy who wrote comics, which let's be honest, especially the time period we're talking about, very male dominated field to work in and also to read. But the fact that he had these women that were working so closely with him, what did you think when you found out about that?
Well, I thought that was really nice, and I like that you touched on it as well. Because, you know, obviously I didn't know much about it, so to know that they were all counting on each other, and it was a collaborative effort, so that was really nice. And I liked their interactions on camera, because of course, you know, we're getting everyone's different, you know, sides of how everything happened back then. But to see all of them together, it was just like they were back home, like chilling, hanging out, talking about the Marvel.
It was very casual.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Yeah,
on a couch.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you think about the stories that they're just casually remembering, you know, and just the idea that the Mutant Massacre was like, oh, hey, I want to do that too. And she
that
was married
was
to Walter Simonson, who was doing Thor at the time, which I remember, like, what is Thor doing here? You know, but that was, you know, the first big crossover. And as great as that story was and as well orchestrated as it was, it kind of was one of the, it wasn't really the beginning of the end, but it was definitely like, okay, so we can monetize this even more. So now as you talk about in the film. It's like, so now you're going to do that like every fall. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think that I, as a comic reader, you know, I was in like middle school and into high school at this point. I liked the first few of those. I think like Inferno was really well done. A lot of those stories were well done. And then they started to get like, wow, they're really like branching out like which comics are involved and crossing over. And, you know, there was a cover from the Extinction Agenda. I'm like, I don't remember anything about that. I read it. I definitely read it, but I don't remember it.
Yeah.
And the other ones, I remember so many things about the stories.
I think those ones, the Mutant Massacre and Fall of the Mutants are not really, they are like adjacent stories. They're not really crossing over. Like they kind of brush paths with each other. And Fall of the Mutants is just a theme, really. Yeah. It's not actually a narrative crossover. So Inferno is the first one that is really like one story across, you know, nine issues.
Yeah, and I think like Spider-Man shows up in that. Like they were
they had a whole theme of like the New York. Essentially, it was like a Ghostbusters-esque scenario where like things were coming to life and New York was haunted. So I think that one works from a narrative point of view. It's sort of the culmination of this whole, you know, Jean Grey saga and Matty Pryor, et cetera, all kinds of things. So it kind of brings that to a satisfying close. And then I think you're correct, like, the later ones feel a little more like, well, we got to do something, so
here's this. And then it's like, oh, and you can buy four variations of that cover, and they're, you know, and they're bagged with a little collectible card, and that's right around the time where I kind of fell off, you know, it was just like... I don't know, just don't be so shameless about the marketing aspect of it. You know, tell good stories and then make them collectible and people will buy them for that reason. You know, and I know that we referenced the Jim Lee X-Men number one. That did have multiple different covers, so that's how you sell 8 million copies. Yeah. But at the same time, those were still good stories.
Yeah.
That had five covers.
Yeah, because the one that I have is the one that it folds out, and it's all of them. And
I have all five.
Of course you do. But they're great, you know? Yeah. Well, we'll sort of touch a little bit more on the Jim Lee era, but when I wanted to kind of go back and talk about the importance of the characters themselves, and something that I noticed when I interviewed Chris for my podcast, The Blockcast, in 2014, and I was told that he had about half an hour, and he ended up talking to me for 90 minutes and could have done more, you know, you could tell, but I was just like, I don't want to take up all this time, you know? And the thing that I liked the most was the way he talks about the characters. He doesn't ever say Wolverine. He doesn't say Cyclops. He talks about Logan and Scott. Mm. And I love that he calls Professor X Charlie. 100% of the time, he calls him Charlie.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that he's that fond of the characters. And I guess if you write them for 17 years, you definitely are going to get fond of them. But you feel like people that wrote later X-Men stories, there's great X-Men stories that happen after he left. But you don't feel like there's that kind of connection, you know?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I wanted to do with the movie was sort of, you know, in a little, like, pretentious terms, to, like, position the X-Men as, like, an auteur text or an auteur project, because I think it's Claremont's themes, it's Claremont's characters, it's Claremont's story, and it all kind of goes back to him and sort of, and Anne and Louise and the artists, but it's really him driving it. And I think everything that's after is sort of riffing on what he's done, if not specifically the characters, it's like literally the stories that he did or, you know, the themes that he did. And even in Stan Lee, I mean, people will cite like Magneto was Malcolm X, Professor X was Martin Luther King sort of thing. Like if you read the Stan Lee era, it's not really there. Like that's a theme that he really brought to it and kind
It's exactly. That's really the fundamental difference, because the Stan Lee Magneto, I mean, he might as well be Dr. Doom or Lex Luthor, or, you know, I mean, and it's not even necessarily a bad thing. It's just so multi-layered. And I really liked the moment where it was discussed in the film that, you know, the idea that he was positioning Magneto to actually take over the X-Men, he specifically had it mapped out for issue 300. He would have had to hang on for just a couple more years.
Yeah.
But that's not the way it went. But that moment when Magneto realizes, you know, he hurts Kitty in Uncanny X-Men 150. It's not just a child, it's a Jewish child, and he is a survivor of the Holocaust, which is so hard to do now, to have him be a survivor of the Holocaust when you think of how many years ago that was.
Yeah.
But it's such an important part of his character that I am glad that they've kept it in the movies, you know, that and to the extent that we even see it in X-Men First Class. So, you know, it's he's such a complicated person. You can't actually call Magneto, even though he was the leader of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. He's not evil, you know. He just has a different blueprint. Mm-hmm. You know?
And I think it is fun if you read the whole thing. You see Chris write him as sort of that, you know, kind of Dr. Doomy type. He has like an evil volcano lair and right. stuff, but he has sort of a humanity. And then it takes a long time, and some of it unfolds in New Mutants. But you do see him become that better person, and he's kind of he's basically with the X-Men in a good chunk of the run.
Through the late 80s and then there's the big trial of Magneto in X-Men 200, and you know, it's sort of built up to that with one of the worst costumes ever, the Magneto costume, with the big M. You know who's in that story? Fenris. Anyway, Michael doesn't appreciate how excited I was that Fenris show up, even though it's just in flashback, on The Gifted. And I was like, I was looking for things to be excited about for that show. But that's a good way to sort of transition about how we've seen these things translate to the big screen. Talk a little bit about, I don't think I was aware of this, talk about the memo that Chris wrote that sort of helped the first X-Men movie actually happen.
Well, yeah, I think X-Men had been in development for many, many years, and it never, you know...
James Cameron was supposed to do one in, like, the late 80s. Well, rumored, yeah, but I'd heard about it for years. Yeah.
I mean, it made a lot of sense, but at the time, you know, late 90s, it was Batman and Robin had just come out. It was kind of a darker time for superheroes on screen, and Chris wrote sort of a memo to Fox, and he was like, this is what this is about. It's about, you know, kind of the conflict and prejudice and people dealing with feeling like outsiders and sort of feeling excluded and finding the truth in that. And then that sort of became a catalyst or a hook on which they were able to, you know, identify what this movie was about. And I think if you watch the first movie, there is a lot. I mean, the opening scene is like the Magneto in the Holocaust flashback. And there's, you know, it's not a perfect movie, but I think it does capture a lot of what Chris was doing. And you can understand where, you know, the allegory of it comes through.
Yeah, I think the limitations for the first X-Men movie are just budgetary. And that'll tell you so much about, you know, making a movie that came out in 2000. Which is like, we're not going to spend that much money on a superhero movie. You're crazy.
Yeah.
You know, that'd be like putting Robert Downey Jr. in a superhero movie. You know, just it was not the mentality. What were you going to say, Amy?
Well, my question for all of you is, when you hear that a movie is going to be made based off of a comic book, what are your thoughts? Are you excited? Are you apprehensive? Are you like, great?
I mean, at this point, I used to be like very, very excited. At this point, there's so many, I'm kind of like, all right, another one.
Yeah, right. I mean, at that time, you're just like, oh my God, there's going to be an X-Men movie. Yeah. I've waited for this like my whole life.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see what they do with it. And then now when you hear about some of the movies announced, you're like, well, I mean, I guess, because they've done everything else, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, Multiple Man, I'm like, sure. All right, if there's a cool take.
And I'm biased in that I'm excited about the Kitty Pryde movie that's in development. Mm. Even though it's not going to be played by Ellen Page, I think Michael's still not on board.
I don't see it happening.
Well, you know, what they should do is take the Kitty Pryde and Wolverine 6-issue miniseries and just put that on the big screen. But I think second favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, but I think that it's a different world to think about in 2000, because there were no good Marvel movies, you know. So, and there weren't that many good superhero movies. Like the Richard Donner Superman, the first one, it was pretty close. Although you watch it now and you're just like, oh, that third act, yikes.
You know, but I like that Captain America movie a lot.
Oh, the 1990 Captain America. I like the Red Skull in that movie. It. Yeah. And I love the Roger Corman Fantastic Four, but not for the right reasons. Not for the right reasons. But there were like the Tim Burton Batman movies. You know? And you were just like, well, why don't we get that? You know? And so then that first X-Men movie, you're just like, all right, this is cool.
I mean, I think it was interesting because it is a more serious movie, and it's kind of treated with, you know, not like a jokey tone, which now seems like obvious, but I think at the time was a surprise. And I think it's hard to kind of remember then, like, comics were very not respected or not really, you know, popular in the way they are now.
Well, there's a great moment in the film where Ann Nesenti talks about calling Marvel to, you know, it's like, oh, we need writers. Great, what is it? And he's like, we don't want to tell you. And she's like, oh, it's porn. But porn and comics, it was sort of the same thing. And, you know, both arrived in your mailbox in brown paper. As a longtime comic book subscriber, it looked an awful lot like, you know, Playboy coming. So, you know, it was kind of looked at as the same thing. It's just like, oh, comic books, you know? So I think that it was a slow build. I think that X2 was actually really well done because they were able to spend a little bit more money, and I'm very biased because the Beast was
in
it.
I liked it.
Yeah, I was glad we were able to see the Beast, and that story, at least the way that I remember it,
it's
sort of
like the gay Iceman story.
Was that what it was?
That one, yeah.
Yeah, but...
Well, it's God Loves, Man Kills,
that's exactly
basically.
What I was... The next thing out of my mouth was that, to me, that story was Marvel Graphic Novel number 5, which is God Loves, Man Kills, which, if I have to isolate one single story that is not, you know, a multi-issue epic, I think that's the one that captures who the X-Men are and what it's about. That story is really just an allegory for any kind of maligned group, whether it, you know, be ethnic, sexual orientation, anything like that. I think that's what makes the X-Men so accessible, because at some point everybody's felt like, well, yeah, I don't belong, you know? So, and they were doing a really good job, but then all of a sudden you get that X3, which I've already talked about once, but... What we were talking about earlier is the X-Men animated series, and it's a time period where we also had the Spider-Man animated series, and I'll give a shout-out to DC. The Batman animated series and the Superman one were very different, unlike what we had seen before. Now, what I remember from when I was a kid were the Super Friends and Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, and I loved Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. But they were, I mean, they weren't just for kids. They were for, like, slow kids. You know, they were just really simplistic, and they're just telling these advanced stories. And all of the four of the shows that I mentioned would do multi-episode, stories. And I think that X-Men show, that's really what makes those characters so important to so many people like yourself. Mm-hmm. And, I think when the show premiered, I think it was 92, I was already in high school, but I was like, oh, I don't care. I love these characters.
Bringing it back for this
I recorded that show on my VCR when I was in college. I'm like, well, I love the X-Men. Mm. I need to see the Dark Phoenix saga on my TV. Are you crazy?
Yeah.
And I think it was really well done. And just the level of storytelling, it was just not something that you saw, you know, if you, I don't know what the rest of the Fox Saturday lineup was for kids. It wasn't like that, you know, and I think it's just because of the job that, you know, Chris Claremont and of course everyone else did really fleshing out these characters, and the fact that they're so well defined on the page, all you have to do is just not mess it up, you know, to transfer them to the screen. And so many times that's what happens with comic book movies and TV series.
Well, so Logan was the first film that's obviously based off of a comic book that was nominated for an Oscar.
For screenplay.
What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think it was incredibly well written. I mean, and the story it's based on is great. It's not from. It's a much more recent story. It's not a Chris Claremont story, but he gets asked about it, and he's like, "Oh, the movie's very good, but I didn't write it, so I just was watching it." You know, the Wolverine movie before that was very close to the Wolverine miniseries that Chris wrote and some other stories, but I think that was one of the best, you know, comic book movies that I've seen. I mean, because I always like Hugh Jackman, even in the bad one, he's still good in it. And, you know, as bad as that movie is, Liev Schreiber as Sabretooth, I really thought was great. I mean, Michael's like rolling his eyes if you're listening on iTunes, but believe me, I rewatched it a few years ago.
It's just, all of that is just too much for me. Like the Origins, X-Men, Wolverine,
Deadpool's terrible.
Wolverine.
No, in X-Men Origins Wolverine, Deadpool is awful because they don't develop the character correctly. But it's also played by Ryan Reynolds. But anyway, what are your thoughts, though? To Amy's question.
I mean, I loved Logan. I think it was the best X-Men movie to date. And I mean, I think it was just a great movie. Like, I think it kind of... there is a thing, I think, where, like, I'll hear people talk about, like, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 or something, and they're like, oh, it's great. And I'm like, is it, like... kind of, you know, Marvel movie great, or is it like a truly great, great movie? And I think Logan was one where it wasn't just fun, it wasn't just like exciting to piece these different things together. It hit very like emotionally, I think. I mean, I remember like the lights came up, like they turned the lights on immediately after the credits, and you look around and some people were like, dim the lights a little bit.
It's yeah.
A little,
yeah.
It's a little dusty, it's a little in, dusty here. In here.
Yeah. No, I know. And that's absolutely true. And I mean, you know, look, it's a movie where you see both Wolverine and Professor Xavier die, you know? Yeah. And so it's like, that's, you know, those characters have been part of my life since
we
before my wife
saw
was born.
Professor X die anyway.
Well, you know, we see a lot. We see people die all the time, but yeah. You know, just in the context of that story, what did you think about Logan, Michael? Did you?
I haven't seen it yet.
What is wrong with you?
Why would I watch? Spoiled. Why would I watch Logan if I haven't seen Apocalypse?
It's their own connection.
Absolutely no reason to. Well, to yeah. You could have just gone right to Logan.
Logan's supposed to be the last one for him, so I'm going to watch it last.
Your logic is definitely flawed. You already have a DVD to Apocalypse, so I was going to say, I'll bring my Logan DVD to you're like,
I can buy it.
I don't need your trash.
And I like X-23. There's nothing... Yeah. It's just because I was going to watch Apocalypse first.
Right, but you're so put off by Apocalypse.
You know what? I swear to all of you out there, I'm going to go home tonight, and I'm going to watch Apocalypse.
And I'm going to watch all 9 episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah,
we'll catch up on
that. Yeah, yeah, let's stop deflecting on, like, the real, like,
I have 2 kids.
Problem. Oh, my God. You
Also, I've seen Logan 3 times, but anyway, that's besides the point. I think that it's a perfect example, though. I'm glad you brought up Logan, even though it's not, you know, Old Man Logan's not a Chris Claremont
story.
It's like
the third movie. There's X-Men Origins Wolverine, mm-hmm. The Wolverine.
Yeah.
And I kind of, like, by the Wolverine, I was a little like,
Yeah, well, the first 2 acts of the Wolverine I thought were great, and then he, like, gets on his motorcycle and he rides into a different movie that, to me, is not as good of a movie. But anyway, that's a lot of sort of diving into the movie aspect of it. And, you know, obviously it's a lot harder to develop for television, but I did want to talk a little bit about Legion because I watched that show with my wife and she likes these movies, but she doesn't really know the characters that well. And just that show is it's groundbreaking. It's also infuriating because it just plays with your mind so much. But I think that is a direct correlation to, as we said earlier, the stories that Chris wrote with Bill Sienkiewicz, that it was just like, I mean, just look at what those comics looked like. And it was like, I don't understand how those were being printed on newsprint in 1985.
Yeah.
But they were. Talk a little bit about how you think they were able to kind of take this character of David and you know, build a whole show around him.
Well, I mean, I think part of it's a sort of a testament to, like, Chris's versatility as a writer in that, you know, we associate him with, like, the cosmic epic of Dark Phoenix or the, you know, sort of political, allegorical kind of things of Days of Future Past, but he could also do a lot of, like, really kind of trippy out there stuff. And I think, like, the Demon Bear with Sienkiewicz or Legion are great examples of that. And it's cool. I think you could see how many different pieces of, you know, like, people would call it like IP, but kind of like concepts in his run can be harvested out. I would never have thought, like, the guy from Fargo should make a TV show out of Legion.
Right.
But it was a great pairing. And I think it's very experimental in the same way that the comics are. And it's just, I mean, it's a crazy show. Like, even kind of knowing what was going on generally, I was like, what's going on?
And by the way, as I've mentioned before on the show, my wife watched the whole first season and didn't take away from the fact that Professor Xavier is his father. Mm. So it's like, you know, there's like one shot where you see like the X
wheelchair. Yeah.
But if you're not really thinking about it, it's so I like the way that they've told the story, which is like,
yeah,
we don't need to know that yet.
Yeah, I told my wife that, and she was like, why'd you spoiler me? And I was like, it was in there.
It was in there, but like, you know, she might not have picked up on it.
Yeah, it's very minimal. Yeah. And I think you gain something if you know that, but it's also, you don't really need it. It's just he exists, is built on his own terms in the film.
And, you know, I'm actually going to get a chance to interview Chris again. They wanted to do it around Legion Season 2. So
awesome.
I was kind of excited to actually really get to talk to him about that. But, and it's funny that you mentioned Demon Bear, because all indications were that's what the New Mutants movie at least was going to be.
Seems to be, yeah.
Seems to be, but they've like pulled the release back. Right? Yeah, so I was excited about that because it seems like, I mean, first of all, it's not a story that I would make into a movie, but yeah. It's great that they wanted to tell a different style movie. You know, I think the superhero horror movie would be great. I mean, there are definitely plenty of instances. You know, there's very dark stories that you know. I mean, I think I mentioned on this show recently. If you take the Spider-Man story, Kraven's Last Hunt, like that's a very dark story. Mm. But you don't want to put that in a Spider-Man story because Spider-Man, it's like, oh, it's fun, it's light, and you know. But I think you can really do that when you're doing the first movie for something like New Mutants.
Well, I think New Mutants definitely had more of kind of a darker tone, and it was sort of that, like, you know, puberty out of control metaphor of, you know, turning into a wolf or blowing stuff up as a nuclear sunspot or whatever his powers were derived from. So it was very, I think it's very appropriate, and I think it's, I think the coolest thing about movies like Logan or even Deadpool is that, or Legion, it's they're coming at stuff from a different angle because they don't have to sort of represent the whole of the genre. They don't have to be, it's like there's so many superheroes now, you have to do something different to stand out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that I want to touch on before, we're almost out of time, which is crazy, but hopefully we get to talk again sometime soon, Patrick. And we'll talk about your horror movie in a moment. But one of the things that you touch on in there is in Chris Claremont's X-Men, your documentary, which is available video on demand, Amazon, iTunes, all the places you expect to find movies these days, and is sort of the proliferation of the artist replacing the writer. And you see that with Jim Lee and Chris Claremont. You saw that when Todd McFarlane took over on Spider-Man. You see Rob Liefeld take over from Louis Simonson. And it just turned into like, well, what do you want to draw? We're going to do that. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I always harp on that was like the thing that started to drive me crazy with that is, why is Captain Britain's sister Asian now? Because why didn't you just create a new character? Why did you have to do that to, you know? And it drove me crazy. It's like, oh, probably Jim Lee just thought it'd be cool to draw her like that.
I always felt, which wasn't backed up by the subsequent stories, that Chris never intended for her to turn Asian.
Yeah,
she was just, because it's never mentioned in like the story.
Right. It's just she's turning Japanese. I really think so.
Yeah. Oh my god, we should have had that plan.
Well, I didn't know we were going to go there. But, and I think you're right. And I think that's one of those things that he was just like, I don't think I need to do this anymore.
It's subsequent stories where they have some kind of thing where she swapped bodies with somebody or whatever.
I honestly don't even remember. I know the Mandarin was involved, which was kind of interesting. But
Well, yeah, I think that was a unique time because now it's very writer-driven in comics, and it's most people can't draw a book a month, so artists are kind of, you know, secondary in the marketing. Yeah. But I think it was just a unique time when those guys hit with the audience in such a way. And I think Claremont had been around so long that there was a, you know, the management was like, we're going to go with these newer people. And it sucks for him.
These are the ones who are, you know, they're drawing covers for X-Men number one, X-Force number one, all this stuff. We're going to go with them. Fascinating conversation. I really enjoyed the documentary. It's a topic that is very near and dear to my heart. We're pretty much out of time, but I do want to give you a moment. Talk a little bit about House of Demons, how it came about that you directed this horror movie.
Sure. So it's a horror movie. It's a very kind of like trippy horror movie. It stars a lot of people you might be familiar with, like Amber Benson from Buffy, Tiffany Smith, who hosts DC All Access, Whitney Moore, who hosts DC All Access, a lot of kind of your podcasting brethren. It's basically about kind of four friends who go to a house that used to be home to a Manson family-like cult that did sort of black magic crossed with science experiments that blur space and time and turn the house into kind of like a manifestation of people's subconscious. And all sort of, they have to face their demons and either kind of overcome them or get destroyed by them.
Right. And so I know that you've done some other, you know, documentary style work, but was this your first narrative?
Narrative feature, right. Yep.
And again, it is called House of Demons. And what I know from your Twitter, at Patrick Meany, that apparently there's a signing with the cast in Burbank this Saturday.
At Dark Delicacies. Yeah. So, yep, Taliesin Jaffe, who you might know from Critical Role, which is very popular, Tiffany Smith, a bunch of the other actors. That's a great opportunity to come out, get it signed, and talk some X-Men as well.
Right, exactly. So, Patrick, thank you so much for sitting here with us. Obviously, we could have done this for a lot longer. And look, I'm just going to say to the rest of my panel, everybody's got a little bit of homework to do. I can't believe you haven't seen Logan. I don't even know if I can talk to you next week. If you haven't watched it by next week, I don't know. There might be a problem.
It's an X-Men show, right?
No, it's a Marvel show. Okay. It's fine. Yeah, I'm just giving him a hard time. Yeah.
Shield, whatever. Shield.
One of these things is really good. Logan. Anyway, yeah. Thank you so much to Patrick Meany, at Patrick Meany. And again, both Chris Claremont's X-Men and House of Demons are available on Amazon, iTunes, On Demand. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, at ChristianDMZ. And I'm going to pin a link to my conversation with Chris Claremont from 2014. If you want to find that, you'll find that on my Twitter. Amy, where can people find you?
On all social media, at AmyCassandraMTZ.
Michael X Factor Shirley.
Michael X Shirley on Twitter and Instagram. You can find it.
And as I mentioned, at Patrick Meany, M-E-A-N-E-Y, and PatrickMeany.com.
Yep.
Thanks so much, everybody. And we will see you next week. And as we always say, Excelsior!
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later!
The views expressed herein are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.